The talk tonight is called Buddha in Your Briefcase. Less stress, more satisfaction, more spirituality even at work. So it's a continuation of this sporadic series on the Eightfold Path, and we are on Wise Livelihood. A little tiny topic, how to make work more spiritual. A huge thing. Here's what one Zen master says about work. Happiness is primarily a matter of work that is fulfilling. There are many other factors within happiness, of course. A nice marriage, a relationship, economic security, intellectual and artistic stimulation, and so on. But if the job is unsatisfactory, nothing else can really compensate. Yep. So, it's huge, applying spirituality to work. And, you know, work just, it can be such an opportunity for creativity and growth and stimulation and passion, and it can be like, so it can be a chance for all that, and it can be such a source of stress, and it's just nothing but one problem after another, and we've all been there, I'm sure. And so just thought I would, so much of comedy, you know, and TV and movies is about work, and just like how inane and silly and difficult work can be. And my sweetie and I have always liked the show 30 Rock. So witty and so fast, and it's such a workplace comedy. I mean, so much fun being poked at the workplace. And Tina Fey just doing a really good job about showing herself as Liz Lemon, as this totally neurotic, anxious, controlling, person who's kind of, you know, say things like, well, I'm going to go talk to some food about this when she's stressed. She just pokes a lot of fun at herself. And somehow lovable because she's, you know, just exposing all her flaws. You wonder what the real Tina's like, if she's like Liz Lemon or not. So she's so much like in some kind of work stress situation that when she's happy, her underlings are kind of uncomfortable. They're just not used to it. And so in one episode, she's fallen in love, and she's kind of on cloud nine, just nothing can bother her, and she's running a meeting of comedy writers. If you don't know the show, it's sort of like her when she was at Saturday Night Live, and it's like a team that's creating a weekly comedy show, and it's all the stuff that goes on in the background. And so anyway, so there's a comedy meeting, one of the comedy meeting on writing a skit or something, and one of the writers walks in late. This guy is named Lutz, and he's kind of like made fun of as being kind of a nerdy guy on the show. And he says, sorry, I'm late. And she's like, it's okay, I'm just glad you're here. She gives him a big hug, and then she takes his face and squeezes his cheeks, both cheeks, and says, oh, you've got a face like a baby's bottom. And then she just pushes even more so that he has like fish lips. And then Frank, another comedy writer, self-described dirtbag, unshaven, cynical, always wears a hat with some strange phrase on it like head cheese or mama's boy. And he says, I hate it when you're in a good mood. It makes me feel unsafe. Like when my mom used to make daiquiris and sing Tanya Tucker songs. And then Kenneth comes in. Miss Lemon, Mr. Donaghy needs you immediately. He's at Christie's. Donaghy's her boss. The show is run by NBC, which is owned by GE, and GE is owned by Shinehart Wig Company, the huge mega corporation. And Jack is the head of East Coast Television and Microwave Programming. He's filthy rich, highly materialistic, conservative and sexist, played very well by Alec Baldwin. His approach to work is, after a heart attack, from his hospital bed, he tells Liz Lemon, "My whole life flashed before me." He'd had, you know, this heart attack. So major events, like when I personally coined the phrase, "What's the upside?" "After all these years, I have only one regret. I should have worked more." So Liz Lemon hears that Jack, her boss, is at Christie's, and she's got to go help him out. She's always, like, trying to help him. He's making her help him. And Liz is like, "Oh, no, Jack goes to Sbarro's when he's angry, the New York Stock Exchange when he's horny, and Christie's when he's depressed." Oh, boy. And she gets this worried, typical expression on her face about how she's going to help him out of this one. And then Frank says, "Yeah, that's the Liz face I'm comfortable with." So, I mean, you kind of have to see the show. I can't recreate it very well. But again, it's just poking fun at all the stress that work can just be. It's so intense, and there's so much on the line, and there's interpersonal conflict, and there's unhappy customers or unhappy this or that. And so that's just the side of work that obviously we really need to bring our Dharma practice to. But so then there's this whole other side of work where it's just such a place for us to discover ourselves and find our passion and feel so good that we can do something that makes us happy that can also benefit others. And so here's another more serious work story. Masatake Morita, forgive me if I'm not pronouncing that right, was a sickly Japanese psychiatry student. Had a lot of insomnia, digestive issues. His father went broke, and he stopped paying for school. And Masatake felt really betrayed. And to get back at his family, he decided to stop taking his medication for his various ailments, and he would just overwork himself to death, basically study himself to death, is his quote. And instead of slowly dying, he began thriving. His health improved. He excelled in school, and he just underwent what he called a miraculous transformation due to the healing power of work. It's not something you usually think about when you think of work in our culture, right? We don't think of the healing power of work. But he developed a whole psychotherapy around it. I forget what it's called. Does anyone know this therapy? Morita, somehow. Based on his name. I don't remember the name of it. But the way effort towards work can really help heal a range of mental health issues. Finding meaning, finding passion, you know, finding a way to contribute. So, again, so both sides of work, we all know this. So you know the famous Freud quote, "Life is about two things, work and love." Sums it up pretty well, don't you think? He wouldn't say God, and I guess as a Buddhist I wouldn't either, but I would put spirituality in there in addition to work and love and play. There's a few things in life. So work is this big thing, and just like the question, do you eat to live or live to eat? Do you work to live or live to work? And it seems like we're part of a culture where for a lot of us it's the latter. We live to work. Work is so demanding, complex, you know, demanding of our time, that it just sucks away a lot of our life force. So if we want to make work not be an obstacle to our spiritual path, but a part of our spiritual path, we need to nudge it from living to work to working to live. And I'm guessing most of us already know that. But, you know, we may have been brought up to where work, our work identity is our identity, and the only way to be happy is to be successful and to be good at something. And all of that is sort of putting work as the be-all and end-all, as opposed to being deeply connected to your passion, to what you really want out of life, to your spiritual yearning, and then figuring out how work can be of service to that, as opposed to the other way around. That's a big challenge, to really make our work life reflect our heart's yearnings, our deepest longings. So that'll be a part where, you know, I'll probably next time really talk about how to make our work reflect our values. Tonight I'm going to focus more on how we can make work that we may already be doing more sacred. And also, hopefully we can get to making it less stressful tonight. So this might be a different view towards work than you're used to. The Benedictine motto is, to pray is to work is to pray. We might think that our spiritual life and our religious life is only mental. It's just something we do on the cushion in our spiritual practice. And the rest of our life is just going about our business, and then we'll be spiritual again the next time we meditate or go to church or whatever we do. This is like the complete opposite of that. And doesn't that make sense? Wouldn't we want our every action to be spiritual, to make our work prayer, actually an expression of our spiritual life, as opposed to something compartmentalized we do from 9 to 5 and don't have our real values engaged? And this is from the Tao, the Tao Te Ching. Is your practice sacred and your work profane? Then your mind is separated from itself, from oneness, from the Tao. Keep your mind free of divisions and distinctions. When your mind is detached, simple, quiet, then all things can exist in harmony and you begin to perceive the truth. Again, that's really, if we have that distinction somehow, even if your work is like, you know, being a barista somewhere, we can make it sacred. We can make it an expression of our path. So how do we do that? So one thing is just the remembrance. And this is be a little variation on, you know, a really straightforward Buddhist contemplation, just contemplating our mortality. And given our mortality, and given our uncertain length of time left, what is important to us? And in the Buddhist tradition, it's when I was in the monastery, it was recommended to do this every single day, to actually reflect on the fact that though our death is certain, what's uncertain is when. We don't know. We act as if we're just going to be around. And it can be shocking, you know, when people around us die. And we had a good friend. We just got a call one day that he had committed suicide. I mean, we're just going about our life. This is 6 weeks ago. I mean, utterly shocking. You know, mortality is all around us. And, you know, the only silver lining in someone we know dying is that it's a reminder to us that this can happen to us. So for some of you, it may not feel quite right to always be thinking about, well, I'm going to die. Like, instead of kind of motivating you, which is what it's designed to do, it could depress you. So you could flip it around if it has that effect on you. Think about the fact that you got born. And without your bidding or asking, the biggest miracle of all, the biggest gift you could ever be given, has already been given to you, right? Our lives. So given that, given this amazing, just amazing fact, it's all gravy after that, right? I mean, we're alive. That's the biggest miracle. And to tune into that, just feel your pulse. If you would, just put your fingers on either side of your Adam's apple. And feel the life force. If you really get your fingers there in the notch around the Adam's apple, you can feel how strong your heart is. It's good to feel that. We are vital and alive. And the miracle happened at our birth, but it's actually happening all day long. Without our asking, our heart is just doing this. Isn't it amazing? So we have this miraculous, precious life force. What do we want to do with it? How do we want to be? So just that reflection, doing something like this every day, when you start the day, remembering your mortality or remembering the miraculousness of your precious life force, it can help you reorient. It can help you be how it matters to you to be wherever you are, whatever you're doing. So this is one way to just take what you're already doing and impregnate it with the preciousness, the miraculousness of existence. Whatever you're doing, it's you there doing it in this precious, precious, vital life force. So this is one way to get our spiritual practice off the cushion. And then a second way to make work feel more sacred to you is to remember the three secrets of work. We all know the three secrets of real estate, right? Location, location, location. And what are the three secrets of work? People, people, people. Ultimately, work at its best, if we remember this, is people working together to help other people. It's not just showing up and punching in to the clock and putting in your time, you know, and twiddling your thumbs so you can get home and then start to live again. If we can orient to the fact that what we're doing is somehow, in some way, contributing, even if it's small. I mean, even if you're editing textbooks, you know, or editing manuals on how to use electronic equipment, I mean, it's still helping. And if you remember that, it feels good. And then we can take that orientation that I'm working with other people to help other people, and then know that that kind of more altruistic, more connected kind of view of things is deeply helpful to your spiritual path. And that, you know, this is one way where work become part of your path of awakening. I mean, the Buddha put this on the Eightfold Path, you know, his view of how to awaken. So we've got to use work to help us awaken. And so one way to do this is to remember our bodhisattva heart, the bodhisattva ethic, that it feels good. When we really get clear, the more clear we are, the more we want to help. If we don't want to help, not to judge ourselves, but we're probably actually confused in some way. There's some way in which we're not seeing clearly. When we really see clearly and are aligned with the way things are, we want to help. We like to help. It makes us happy. So just the spirit of it, you know, you see in Tibetan Buddhism so much. So here's Shantideva, an ancient Tibetan saint, talking about the bodhisattva ethic. Letting work be an act of love and service as opposed to just punching the clock. So he's actually talking about the spirit of awakening, but this is what he says. This is how he wants to help himself awaken. He says, "May I be a protector for those who are without protectors, a guide for travelers, and a boat, a bridge, and a ship for those who wish to cross over. May I be a lamp for those who seek light, a bed for those who seek rest, and may I be a servant for all beings who desire a servant." Just feel his heart. "To all sentient beings, may I be a wish-fulfilling gem, a vase of good fortune, an efficacious mantra, a great medication, a wish-fulfilling tree, and a wish-granting cow." "Just as earth and other elements are useful in various ways to innumerable sentient beings dwelling through infinite space, so may I be in various ways a source of life for the sentient beings present throughout space until they are all liberated." This is his path. So if you would, just take a moment and feel that energy of wanting to help in your heart, and then apply it to your work. Just contemplate, in what ways is your work involve working with others? In what way does it involve helping to help others? Helping you and your workmates help others. Just think about that a little bit. See the service in it, in what you're already doing. Doesn't matter what you're doing, there's service in it. There's some way in which it's meant to help others. And see if you can feel your heart liking to help. See if you can feel your heart wanting to know that it's helping some way. So anyone want to comment here? Say, just contribute something.
That last part of what you were talking about earlier, been playing with that at work in terms of, because I realized that I was just dealing with people in that situation, like when you said a few minutes ago, making this division or this distinction between work life and, you know, other aspects of life. Just seeing people as that, somebody who has a job description that relates to mine in a certain way or something. You know, as opposed to, it's been pretty fulfilling to play with, reflecting on the fact that the people that I interact with, they're just one, in a paralyzed way, like one case at a time, when I can remember to do this. Reflect on the fact that they have a particular conditioning and they suffer and they have things going on in their lives, you know, that are painful. And I don't know, in a way that's enriched and sort of offset some of the discontented feelings that I've had at times with.
Yeah.
I'm not feeling as interested in my work as I have been in the past.
Right.
And it's like I'm moving in that direction with it somehow.
So just to summarize for the mic, basically for you, when you're feeling in the doldrums, not so inspired with work, you find it really helpful to reflect on, like, basically the humanity of people that are in your work environment, and not, you know, you're sort of going outside the box there. Definitely. Three secrets of work. People, people, people. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a statistician. It's still, you know, work cooperating with others to help others. Even if what you're helping someone do is understand multiple regression. But it's so easy to lose sight of it. And we get blinded to by ambition. And, you know, I'm just trying to, like, get really good at something. And then we lose sight of the fact that we can collaborate with others to help others.
As I mentioned to you before, Peter, my work has been in popular things such as Wall Street, firearms, and coal mining. But throughout that period and continuing now, I've done a tremendous amount of volunteer work. And all of my volunteer work has been, in effect, helping people in some fashion. So that hopefully it's counterbalanced somewhat. But if there were actually negative things in my place.
I would say, even with volunteer work, when we know it's about service and what we're doing, it's still helpful to remember. Oh, right. I remember being in hospice volunteer, and I really like interacting with the hospice patients. But I wasn't always getting to do that. I was often cooking meals, and I would just get kind of like, well, this is not really what I'm here for. And then so I'd have to tune into, yeah, and it's helping. I'm feeding people, right? That's a pretty deep thing. So sometimes we need to remind ourselves that it's still about people, even if it's not direct, even when we're volunteering. But cool.
I'm wondering if there's a strategy. You know, it seems like always going back to the larger view, it's about people, it's about heart, it's about helping. Refreshing, but I'm wondering about when you're sort of in the drudgery of the moment.
Yeah.
You know, is there a piece of the philosophy that can pertain to taking that on without stepping back, you know, but sort of getting in deeper into the microcosmic level of your work? Or, you know, for me, it's lots of times I'm just into problem solving.
Yes.
Problem solving. You know,
yes.
Problems.
Right.
But without sort of stepping out and, taking that larger view, which is helpful.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if there's some other way to be zooming in, you know, and sort of working at a tighter level and appreciating exactly what I'm doing. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think I can address your question better if you're specific. What's an example of a problem that you're just, you know, that...
Well, I'm an architect, so,
okay.
You know, there's a million problems.
Right. Of course. Okay.
It's wrong.
Right.
How does this
right.
come together? So that sort of thing goes on.
So, I'm not sure I know of another way.
I just thought there might be.
Yeah. Because I do think we need reminders because, again, the way our world is, we're so compartmentalized and we lose the human perspective. When we're in touch with the human perspective, it's automatically better. Mm-hmm. But when we're doing something in a specialized way for someone we don't know or, you know, maybe only know a little bit, and then there's a very technical problem that takes a lot of skill and experience to solve, we just get kind of divorced from the people world. So, and I know this from being a scientist and just being totally lost in a scientific problem. I think for me, always helpful to remember the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And I'm tiny, and I'm doing something tiny, but all of us together are doing tiny things, and together we make a big difference. Like, that was very helpful for me in the conservation field, to know that I was part... I would consciously need to get it that I was part of a bigger endeavor to feel that my little tiny thing could do anything. Because we all change together, you know, in small ways, but over time in big ways. So having said that, let me then say one other thing which might relate. When you're really in there, really get into the mastery of it. Really feel the skill and the mastery and the experience that can help you solve a problem. No one else without that skill could solve that problem. You have a particular expertise and skill that feels really good, intrinsically feels good to solve a problem based on all of your experience. And then, so that could be help you as you're in the marrow of a problem, but then you definitely need to back out of that problem at times and remember.
As you were talking, I just had another thought that there's a way of looking upon even these little things as a sacred task.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That every little piece of work, putting away the dishes, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, that in that way, maybe every little
yes, and
solved is a sacred task.
If you could be mindful while you're doing those little tasks, that would be really sacred. But that's very hard when we're intellectually in the marrow and very small details, intricate details of a problem. We have to use so much of our brain energy for that kind of, you know, problem-solving mind. It's hard. But that would be really cool if you could remember to be mindful and notice how it feels. You know, to be doing what you're doing. But again, the mastery piece is something that we sometimes don't take time to celebrate in ourselves. You know? That's your skill is really a gift. I mean, if you can solve problems and help people get what they want and have an aesthetically beautiful environment, like, that makes a big difference to people. So...
One of the things I've been working hard to get, and it's been difficult, is some kind of real routine in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fortunate enough to be able to stay at home. I'm mostly a visual artist, mm-hmm. and I've just got all these other things just clamoring for my attention all the time. And also, I tend to over-commit with everything from volunteer work to whatever.
Yeah.
But I discover that there's one thing that I do that I really love to do that is kind of like putting up the dishes, and it's the laundry.
Yeah.
And I don't put it in the dryer. I have this very particular way of putting it over these racks, and it's always exactly the same every week. And I it's the one thing I do usually on one particular day.
Yeah.
And it's funny because it's one thing that really works for me, and I actually take pleasure in it.
Great.
And I just would love to be able to bring that to more other things that I do.
Yeah. Well, partly what I hear is when we're doing something that's purely physical, that would be considered menial,
mm-hmm.
We don't need to use our brain to do lots of computational or conceptual intricate stuff, it's much easier to be mindful.
Yeah, that's true.
And there's one very famous Zen master, Son Sennim, who folded laundry as his day job in Providence. He was from Korea, but that was his day job. He folded laundry. because it was so zen. So this is one of the tricks with your work life, is to find those times where it's easier to be mindful. And it's usually a time when we're just able to be physical in some way. So when I've done carpentry in the past, when I'm intricately trying to solve a cornice or something, you know, harder. But when I'm walking to get a board and then I go to saw the board, the headspace is gone. I don't need all of that intricate stuff. I can really get it now. Now's the time to really be mindful. And it works. So look for those times in your work when it's simpler and it's easier then.
Another thing I've done fairly recently is when I do manage to make the time to make my artwork, I used to play music, and I stopped doing that, and I work in silence, and it's kind of surprisingly helpful.
Yes, less is more sometimes. Cool. Okay, so another way to make your work more spiritual, this is very simple. Change your motivation from ego-based to service-based. And that sounds so simple and almost trite, but it's powerful. So I remember hearing the Dalai Lama, you know, someone asked him, like, well, you know, you're speaking in public so much, and you know, that's the people's biggest fear, like fear of public speaking. Do you ever get nervous? And Dalai Lama said, no, not really, but maybe occasionally. But as soon as I do, then I remember what I'm doing. I'm doing this to do my best to help others. And as soon as I remember that, then I'm not nervous anymore. You can just hear the shift to, like, how am I doing to, oh, how are you doing? You know, like that what we do, and that changed me as I was a professor at a lecturer at the University of Vermont at that time in wildlife biology, and it helped me so much to remember that, because I was so, you know, it's academia, everyone's focused on, like, how am I doing, I've got to prove myself, and it's like, actually, I could go for excellence, just as much motivation to go for excellence, because it's beneficial to others to really know something well, to teach it well, to engage the students with the material. I could really want to excel because I could better serve. And that's just it's a simple little shift that's really helpful. Any comments on that? Anyone who hasn't said something yet who wants to say something? Not to put you on the spot.
I guess that service mind view could help me to feel less fear around providing for my own basic needs.
Right.
To stop worrying about strategies like money to provide adequate whatever. but just to know that I'm providing a service. I think that mindset is also very powerful for negotiations, because taking away that fear and dedication to one strategy, such as money, and instead making the focus on, hey, I'm here for you, it kind of expands the pie, makes it more likely that I can get my needs met in mm-hmm. some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
In part because if I take care of other people, they're more likely to take care of me.
Exactly. So the comment, and I just always repeat things for them, like I try to remember anyway, the comment is that when you take your sort of your frame away out of just making money and think more about being of service to others, you didn't use this word, but I'll use it, there's actually more, in a way, more security, because you can feel that you're taking care of others, and it's quite possible, likely, that when you do that a lot, people are going to take care of you in the time of need. Right, and so we think of work as money, you know, and that's a very narrow thing. It's just like the thing that gets spit out at the end of the activity, right? I mean, you know, that gives us a certain kind of security, which we need. We all need that. But it's not, it doesn't let the heart necessarily stop and rest and feel the security, you know, of kind of a big, being part of a big connected thing.
Mm-hmm. This has been really good for me because I've always been like, I felt like I was always like the caretaker because I taught school, you know, sixth graders, and then I helped manage a hostel, and then I helped manage a spiritual center, and now I'm taking care of my granddaughter for the last three years, and I'm not, I just have her, you know, there's not all these other people, and it's been a struggle. I love her so much, and I have to just keep bringing it back that I'm here as a service for her. I'm with her so many hours.
Exactly.
But it's really, that's good to hear, because I have to bring myself back
totally.
Because I'm one-on-one now, and I'm not used to that, so it's been hard not being around adults.
Definitely.
It's different kinds of demands. And it's different kinds of demands for me. So, you know, it's been interesting these last 3 years for me. So it's like, I look at it as a job.
Yeah.
It is a job.
Yeah.
And I know it will pass quickly because it already has. And then, you know, I hope to get back out in the world of people, of adults again. But, but you know, it's been good. Thank you.
You know, and one of the other attitudes that can help so much at work, and this is so important, is to really take refuge in your own activity, your intentions, and your actions. And let that be the thing that's the target, as opposed to the result. And when you, let's just talk about this from the spiritual perspective. In the Buddhist view, what you're doing for is a very spiritual thing, because what you're doing is practicing so many of the perfections of the Buddha, the qualities of the awakened heart. Generosity, kindness, service, truthfulness, equanimity. These are all part of the 10 paramis, perfections. And so that's you. You know, the result, there's, you know, I mean, there's just a being there, and you're helping that person, you know, form themselves in a significant way. But, you know, you may never see that in any direct way that where you could put your finger on it. So the more you can just focus on what you're doing and feel good about, you know, all these qualities that you're developing. I mean, obviously there's great love and joy as part of what you do. But it just, and this is such a key principle for taking action in the world. We can act impeccably, and even when we're not acting impeccably, we are being impeccable, because that's the best we could do in that moment. But we can take refuge in our own integrity and feel good about that, and then we can let go of seeing the results. We want the results, we work towards the results, but they're out of our control, the results. We can't control the results. To try to control what you can't control is suffering. So, this is a little bit of a tangent to what you said, but just one last principle that I wanted to allude to. and I'm looking at time, and we're pretty close, so let's just leave it there and end with some sitting. So, Buddha in Your Briefcase, Part 2, Taking Mindfulness to Work. And really tonight I'm going to focus on mindfulness and mastery at work. So how we can be mindful at work. And then mastery is about really how we can be skilled in our work. And mastery is different from achievement. Achievement is some kind of external orientation where we measure how we're doing in the eyes of others in some way, and we can feel we've achieved something, and that's an external reward that we can get. But a lot of research shows this now, that external rewards are not as effective in making us happy as intrinsic internal rewards. And you know, the obvious reason being that external rewards come and go. We can work our whole lives, you know, and maybe only get recognized once, you know, for something. So, whereas an intrinsic reward is a reward in the very process, the very act of doing your work, that's satisfying to you. Who cares what anybody thinks? So, and there's something very intrinsically rewarding about mastery, about doing something well for its own sake. And so the essence of reducing stress at work is in part being more mindful, and the other part is orienting towards mastery, which is the intrinsic reward related to the process of what you're doing, as well as focused on yourself and your actions, and not taking responsibility for that which you can't control, which is the result of your work. You can do your work, but you can't control how your work is received. And the Tao summarizes very succinctly, so the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu, the author: do your work, then step back. Let's try that again. Do your work, then step back. The only path to surrender. Isn't that just simple and clear? I mean, we would like to think that somehow living the contemplative or more meditative life, you know, sort of buys us an out, that we can kind of go off to some little enlightened cloud and kind of hover above and remove from all the troubles of life. And then that's where we find our peace. That doesn't work. You can go off to a little cloud, but clouds eventually change, and you'll fall off your cloud. That's not very reliable. Instead, we need to find our peace within our stressful lives, within our busy lives, within the chaos and the demands of our work life. If we have to find our peace somewhere else, good luck, right? So what's so robust and powerful about mindfulness is that we can take it anywhere, and we can take our spiritual lives off of our cloud, off of our cushion, and meet with the very marrow of what's good and what's challenging about our work. And we need to be mindful, and then oriented towards mastery the rest of the time. And remembering mastery is about doing something well for its own sake, as well as doing something well to benefit. You know, if we can focus on it's non-ego based to see your work as service in some way. And there's something intrinsically very rewarding about noticing that you're helping. We really like to see that somehow we're helping. That, and that is intrinsic. And again, to focus on the process and not the results. If we focus on doing our work well, as impeccably as we're able to, given our limits and our situation, the more we can kind of like energetically take refuge in that, then we can let go of attachment to results. And we can just learn, maybe. We can maybe learn from results not going as expected. But that's all we can do. We can never take responsibility for results because it's out of our hands, out of our control. Does that make sense? I'm speaking in generalities, I know. But it's a really different orientation to our work. So I'll just invite you to jump in right here. Anyone want to comment, question, elaborate, share a story about what I've said so far? And I'll try to succinctly repeat what you said so that the mic can pick it up. Think about mastery, intrinsic, process-oriented, not attached to results. Think about that in your work. Think about how you can focus on what you're doing and your abilities and your skills and how that's different from the results of what you do. Or let me ask it a different way. Are any of you taking responsibility for what you can't control? Loaded question, right? Okay. Well, I'll just move it on. So you interrupt me. So, does your work cause stress? Are you alive? Do you have a pulse? Yeah. Yes, no.
I think it depends how you handle it. It's like, you know, presence, and it doesn't really, just doesn't make it. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So the comment is that if I'm in the present, my work will stress me out. Yeah.
Also, like the goals, and we've got like goals that we don't know what the goals are.
Yes.
I don't know
what the goals are.
Why do we do that? Makes sense.
We can have goals, and we might sometimes really need very specific goals. But even then, we can't take responsibility. We can only take action towards a goal, given our best understand, but you can't control making the goal happen, but we can control what we do to get there. And if we get there, we get there. If we don't, we don't. Well, generally. Let's think about our mindfulness practice itself. Because wise effort is a microcosm for mindfulness and mastery at work. The essence being, you do what you can do. So like the guy says, do your work, then step back. If you've done what you feel you can do or are willing to do, because you're not always going to do everything you can do, but if you have done what you're willing to do, then for that moment, you're done. So do what you're willing to do, and then relax. And relax while you're doing it. and then stay relaxed when you're done. You know, I mean, it's very easy to say, right? It's hard to put into practice. So, with mindfulness, with wise effort, this is all we can do. You can never become a good meditator. You can't do that. What you can do is sit down for a specified amount of time with an intention to be mindful. And it works best when that intention is connected to your inspiration, like you know that you want to be mindful. It's not a guilt or a should, but there's really a feeling of, yeah, I know I want to be mindful. And our intention comes out of our inspiration, and we're with a few breaths, and then, boom, we're off, you know? We're in, like, some Peter Sellers movie, you know, from the 60s, remembering, you know, does your dog bite, you know? Your dog just bit me, but that is not my dog. Right? And then you're like, oh! Distracted. Now, remember, that's the key moment. At that moment, now you can do something. You can come back and renew your intention and then be with this half breath. That's what you can do. So what you can do is simply return when you realize you're distracted. That's all you can do to become more mindful. And so to judge your practice, I'm a bad meditator, I'm a good meditator, it's really besides the point, because it's not focused on what you can actually do. What you can actually do is sit down with the intention and simply return when you realize you've been distracted. That's all you can do, is become more mindful. Your goal is to become more mindful, but you can't force the goal. What you can do is to not judge your practice, but to just, without comment, come back whenever you realize you've been distracted. That's what you can do. So that's wise effort. And that's doing your work and then stepping back. So that applies very much to our work. We do what we can do, or are willing to do. And the rest is out of our hands. So, the way mindfulness helps reduce stress is it teaches us many, many times about wise effort. It teaches us the difference between when we can take action and when we can't, and just surrender in the end we can. It has a powerful, that's one way of de-stressing, is to stop trying to control what we can't control. And Egel pointed to another way that mindfulness is very powerful at reducing stress. Think about it. All stress is either past or future. There can be something stressful going on in the moment, but it's usually because there's something that needs to happen towards a future goal. Stress is about past and future. Recriminating ourselves for a mistake we made, or getting anxious about, you know, not having enough time to get something done, or being worried, you know, about something in the future. Mindfulness, if you just are in the present moment, you're in your senses, you're aware of your body or your breath, you're in the present moment, where's the stress? There isn't stress in the present moment. Now, there might be unpleasantness, but that's not the same thing as stress. Stress is our reaction, like, oh no. That can be meeting when you're sitting. That's unpleasant. And then the stress is like, oh my God, you know, I'm getting old. My meditation teacher, Joseph Goldstein, you know, he sits in a chair now, you know. Am I going to be like that? It's all this knee pain, you know, going to debilitate my knees. I don't know why he sits in a chair. I don't know if he has some debilitated knees or not. But, right, that's the stress response. It's basically like,
telling ourselves a lot of things that we don't know to be true. So, we can be present, we can be with the play of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and not be stressed. Actually have peace of mind as experience does its bit, the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. That will never stop. The only thing that stops is our relationship to it. We can change that. We can actually just show up for how life is. Exactly. And if we stop arguing with it, we de-stress. And we can actually have peace of mind when the experience is unpleasant, if we're being mindful. So this is the key of how mindfulness de-stresses us at work. So let's take a little time now, just a few minutes, to talk to someone next to you, we'll do this in dyads, about what are the stressors at your work. So just kind of freeform, talk about what stresses you out at work. And then we'll come back together in a few minutes, I'll ring the bell. So right now, if you could take what really stresses you out at work, let's just spend a little bit of time with this. So, if you would, assume your meditative posture, and we'll take a break after this. So we'll just do this for a few minutes. So for you, what floats up to the top that's stressful at work? And in this moment, get it, that there's not a thing you're going to do about it right now. Right? Because you're here. So you're not at work. Clock is off. There's nothing to do right now. So instead of worrying about what to do, show up for yourself. And stress is some kind of like negative reaction to what's happening. If the stressor you're imagining is causing stress, the trick is to, right now in this moment, just contact yourself exactly as you are, thereby avoiding stress about stress. You can just relax immediately. There's nowhere you have to get. Right now you can just relax with what stresses you out at work. And so notice your body. Keep thinking about the stressor at work and notice how that makes your body feel. Paying your particular attention for a particular attention to tension or lack of tension. You want to notice thought and image? What are your thoughts right now as you think about this work stressor? What are the images in your mind? But then ask yourself, what's my mood? How do I feel? And whatever that is, get curious. Oh, this is what it's like to be calm or anxious or stressed. Grounding your attention in the body, the physical experience, if possible, of your mood. And soften into it, even if it's tension in the body, just relax into it with awareness. Notice where the tension is and soften. And now get it. All you're doing right now in this moment is imagining something. Maybe it's, you know, got some correspondence to something real at work. But in this moment, it isn't happening. So just let go now. We'll let go of the work stressor, and just be with yourself. Know your breath. And notice if there's any residual tension in the body. If so, just relax and notice. exactly where that is and how it is. The key ways to de-stress about stress is to actually be off the clock when you're off the clock. Your work isn't happening right now. You made a decision to be here at class, so there's nothing you're going to do about it. So just be present. Let go of the work stress. And just feel your breath. You're aware of your body, you are present. Take a short break. Just a couple of announcements. Okay. So, any interaction wanted around, like, you know, bringing mindfulness to meet the thing that causes. And so there's something liberating about just kind of, instead of trying, these are going to be my words, instead of like running from the stress, I actually just turn.
Yeah. You know, just letting go is what I call turning towards it and just kind of going down.
Yeah.
Okay, before, you know, kind
of and isn't that much harder now with email and the email being in the phone? And, you know, have you ever been out date night and your partner gets an upsetting email related to work on date night? Has that ever happened to you? It's happened to me. It's kind of a buzzkill. But that this is a problem, right? It's we have to actually be really conscious about being off the clock. It's hard enough to be off the clock in here, and now we have this reminder right here that's just throbbing, you know, 24/7. So yeah, and that's one of the things with stress. We don't get a break from stress. Stress can become chronic, and then it gets kind of wired neurologically that we're in a stress response a lot. So if it is extremely productive to take yourself off the clock because it'll de-stress you, and you're a lot less productive when you're stressed. It's constructive, it's productive to not check the email before you go to bed. You know, in the psychological field, anyone who had any sleep issues at all, it's kind of a rule of thumb standard is nothing to do with work for at least 2 hours before going to bed. On the computer screen has blue light in it, and blue light stimulates our serotonin, which keeps us awake, as opposed to stimulating our melatonin, which is what helps us go to sleep. So staring at your computer screen late at night can mess with your sleep for sure. There's programs now that change that so that it takes the blue out of the light in the computer. But still, in terms of stress, yeah, strongly recommend not to do anything related to work near bedtime.
So when I was noticing the stress, and I was exploring physical sensations
yeah.
with all the instructions.
Yeah, of course.
So then I turned to noticing my emotions and my thoughts and my confidence.
Yes.
And I noticed that the stress or fear was around losing opportunity. I could imagine the bad situation happening. The consequence I was very afraid of was just losing my opportunity and my place in the
community.
And that was a new recognition for me. So I think that a lot of the attachment and the stress.
Oh, okay. So just to actually be mindful enough to arrive at why you were stressing somehow was de-stressing. To realize, oh, this is really what it is. It's a loss of opportunity. So in a way, there can be the unknown out there. And that's an unknown, right? You don't know about this opportunity for sure if you're going to get it or lose it, right? That's in the don't know department, right? But what you can know is that, oh, that's what I'm worried about. And there's something about landing on something concrete that somehow is soothing. When we kind of know what's going on inside, it can often be helpful. Yeah. So for you, the practice is sort of a reminder. It's like you wake up out of a stress dream and realize, oh, it's not very real. I can kind of get a break right here. So the key thing, what happened, let's just remember this. I had you imagine the stress at work. And then I had you focus on the fact it's just a thought that's happening right now. That work stress is not happening right now unless I am making it happen by cogitating over it. So this is one way that's really important to realize our thought world is not the real world. We often don't know what's going to happen in the real world. But in our thought world, we act as if it's real, and we don't even know it, and we're imagining a work situation, and we're getting really stressed out. But we can stop in a moment and realize, ooh, stress dream, you know? And then we can let go. There is a choice. We can just let go of it. But we to do that, we have to let what is uncertain be uncertain. We have to let what is not known to be not known for that moment. Does that make sense? So we can be stressed and we can drop into the present moment. We can let go. But often it means we need to be willing to just let what's unclear be unclear. Until you can, take some steps once you're back on the clock to try to make it more clear. But often that's the hook. Is there some uncertain thing we think we have to know or we think we do know? And we don't. So I just have a handout somewhere. Ways to reduce stress at work. So I think it's self-explanatory. I'm just going to highlight a few things. How many of you do a pretty big chunk of your work in front of a computer? actually only about half of the hands went up. Let's see again. How many of you do a big chunk of your work in front of a computer? Yeah, most of us. Yeah. A lot of us have the same job now, right? We drive a computer. As a Dharma teacher, I drive a computer. As a psychotherapist, I drive a computer. We all, you know, if you're a lawyer or a scientist or a screenwriter or a writer or whatever, you drive a computer. So one of the single best things for me in my discovery around bringing mindfulness to work is my little mindfulness bell, which sometimes you hear the go off every 15 minutes during the talk because I forget to turn it off. But you can buy a product. It's not buy, it's free. It's called Prodme. P-R-O-D-M-E. It's the little mindfulness bell that you can, it has a nice sound. Let's see. That's fun. And this is just my personal thing I do. Every 15 minutes it goes off. And I just spend a minute being with my breath. I need that reminder. Because you know how it is, right? Is your inbox an avalanche? You know, does it solidify on impact? Just paralyzed by email and the sheer volume? I mean, God. So, that's for me is a tool, but you need something that's some kind of touchstone in your work day. For some people, believe it or not, the only time you can really take a break is to go use the restroom. And instead of reading the funny pages or whatever, it's a mindfulness break. And maybe you want to use the bathroom a little more than you actually need to get that break. when I was used to be on the research staff at the University of Vermont, in former life, the main administrative assistant for the building, she would take a cigarette break. You know, at least 5 to 10 minutes every couple of hours, she'd be out on the back street smoking a cigarette. I just thought, well, God, if she can do that, like, why can't I just take a mindfulness break 5 minutes every couple of hours? So I started doing walking meditation around the building. 5 minutes, just, you know, every hour or two. Something where you're actually getting a little bit of a reminder that there's something other than going on. And then other people like other things, like using the ring of the phone and let it ring 3 times. If your phone rings a lot, 3 mindful listens. You know, you can make your phone be a cricket or a harp or whatever, right? Really, it's a pleasant sound that you can really enjoy and let it go 3 times before you pick it up. And lastly, there's a little story in the mindfulness-based stress reduction world where a doctor tried to be mindful at work and it was really hard for him, so he would put a... But he found himself looking at the clock. That was the thing he looked at most. So he put a little green dot on the clock to remind him that what he really wanted to do in terms of time was be in the present moment. So the green dot helped him. And then within a few weeks, there were little green dots everywhere in his office as little reminders, little stickies to help him remember, right? Check in. So something. You need something. It's not enough to just, you know, sit some on the cushion and then just go to work and completely be mindless all day, because you're going to stress a lot more. So, okay, I think that's all I'll say about bringing mindfulness into work. Now, let's do an experiential where it's all well and good to sit here on the cushion, you know, nothing to do and follow your breath. Do you think you can be mindful while you're doing something that you've never done before? we're going to combine mindfulness and mastery. So you're going to have a chance to do something and see if you can actually have some kind of mindfulness while you try to do this. So it's origami. And I don't know what you think this is. It's supposed to be a frog. And it's supposed to hop. But this one just sort of flips. Ooh, I did a complete flip. So, I have instructions, which this was sort of an accident the first time, but this time it'll help make the experience a little stronger because the instructions are a little bit unclear. And so you're going to have some origami paper, work with a partner because you might need to, you know, talk to each other. What does that fold actually mean? And you'll each get to do this, but it's a mindfulness exercise. Can you actually stay in your body and notice what's happening while you're doing something? But let the goal be not to make the perfect frog. Let the goal be to show up for the process of making the perfect frog.